How many of you? 13.
That was the first audio and video the world was able to hear of the youth soccer team trapped in a cave in northern Thailand.
We are coming. Many people come.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega, and today, a story that has the world watching. This weekend, dramatic and intense rescue operations began in Thailand's Chiang Rai province to free a group of 12 boys and their soccer coach, who've been trapped in a cave for more than 2 weeks. So far, 8 children have been rescued. 4 remain, along with their coach. The team was exploring the cave when monsoon rains flooded in, and it was 9 days before their exact location was pinpointed. On Friday, a Thai rescue diver died when he ran out of air while underwater. Petty Officer Saman Gunan had delivered oxygen to those trapped in the cave, but on his way back, through the long and complex cave tunnels, he ran out of oxygen for himself and lost consciousness. To get a sense of how these rescue operations happen and what makes them so tricky, we turn to Greg Moore, who's the Northeastern Regional Coordinator for the National Cave Rescue Commission. Greg, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me here.
From what you've been seeing so far, can you give us a sense of the operations that are taking place?
I will start with saying it is probably the largest operation I've seen in any cave rescue because of the complexity and number of people that they are working on rescuing. Typically, in a situation like this, they will have what here in the United States we call an incident command, where they'll have a base of people who are experts that are making the decisions, gathering all the data, and then dividing into various teams, such as, you know, team to pump out the water, a team making medical decisions, and of course, the teams going in to find, evaluate, and help take the boys and the coach out.
Now, I've seen, you know, there's been lots of talk about what it takes to do this, and I want to get into the specifics of how this rescue is happening. But I also wonder if you could help our listeners understand what exactly the depth of this cave is. Do you know any of those details in terms of how far? I'm hearing it takes 2 or 3 hours to bring a child out.
Yeah, I don't know the exact numbers. I've seen 2 kilometers, which I know most listeners are probably thinking, oh, you know, that's not too far of a walk. You know, I could do that pretty quickly. But what people do have to understand is, first of all, even in the dry passages, they can be tight and narrow, which means possibly crawling or moving in a, you know, not easy walking fashion. And then, of course, in this particular cave, they have the huge complication of water-filled passages, which for an experienced cave diver definitely can take some time. And now when you're taking boys who literally this will be their first dive of their lives, they're taking their time moving very slowly because they don't want to make any mistakes.
So let's explain the process, the mechanics of getting these children out of the cave, and of course the coach as well. We're already in process. There have been a number of these children who have already been rescued. What exactly are the cavers doing? When you confront a situation like this, what do you do? What is the first step to actually rescuing people out?
Well, and I'm going to talk mostly of my experience, which is all dry caving, but the hardest part in some cases they've done here, which literally was finding the boys. As you may recall, for nearly 2 weeks, there was a question of where they were and if they could even find them. So when we do an operation, oftentimes, you know, we start out with a search party to find the folks that we're looking for. Once we find them, the next step is generally a medical evaluation. What state are they in? Can they move under their own power? Do they need medical attention? Obviously, in this case, they'd been, I believe, 9 days without food, which definitely means you have to react in a different way. You have to build up their diet. You can't just feed them food right away because their stomachs can't quite handle that. And then after that, you go into a period of planning. A lot of people I know, and I'm as a parent, I'd be one of them, want the children out as quickly as possible. They want to see their loved ones. And I can't blame them. But in a situation like this, you do want to take your time because you want to plan for every possibility. The other huge factor here, and one that I don't think can be overemphasized, is the psychological considerations. For example, you know, if the boys have a leader of the team or something like that, having that leader go first may be a real benefit for them because they can say, hey, if they do it, I can do it. Or conversely, you may want the leader to stay behind in order to boost the morale and cheer up the boys who may be a little more scared or a little more worried about the extraction.
You mentioned psychology, and as I'm listening to this story, I'm having panic about the claustrophobia that I imagine this must feel like. And then we're seeing reports of Elon Musk is talking about putting each of the children into a tube and pulling them out. What do you do about the claustrophobia? What if there is someone who is absolutely in a panic, who cannot handle the trip out?
Sure. I will say, and it surprises some people that know I'm a caver, I've been in a couple tight passages myself where all of a sudden, you know, you get that tightness of chest or whatever, and so I know the feeling. And in one case, I remember just turning to my friend and saying, hey, tell me where you grew up, and just listen to them talk for a few minutes, which calmed me down and made me more comfortable. And then I was able to move just fine. In this case, you know, you're going to do a lot of talking to the boys. You're going to assure them as much as possible. I have seen some people suggest the use of drugs of some sort. I'm not an expert on that. I have spoken to one or two of my medical trained folks who are doctors and cavers. They're dubious of that because there are other side effects, can decrease respiration or other issues. So the doctors on the scene will make that evaluation of whether or not they want to use some sort of anti-anxiety drug or something like that. But generally, the best thing I found is simple, slow, calm talking and reassurance.
Now, what exactly is how are they getting each of these children out? Are they putting diving equipment on them and having them come out? Because we've already seen one diver who's lost his life trying to rescue these kids.
Yeah, and that was a very tragic circumstance, and one that many of us familiar with cave rescue, especially water rescue, had worried about. But most likely they're using full face masks with the boys so they don't have to worry about holding a regulator in their mouth like a normal diver. And then most likely they have at least one, well, they do definitely have one, and most likely have two divers with them, either side by side or one in front and one in back, depending on the side of the passage. There is reportedly one very tight passage there where most likely they have one diver go first, probably turn around and help guide the boy through that while the other second diver is behind the boy. So in that, no case would the boys be left alone or even out of sight of any of the divers. And given the murkiness of the water, most likely the divers are also always in complete physical contact with the boys, partly to give them reassurance and partly to help guide them. Also in situations like this, cave divers will run a line, and the line is used to help them guide which direction they're headed in, because again, the water is so murky, you can't really, even with lights, it's like trying to look through chocolate milk. So they use the guideline to help guide them through the passage.
And just generally speaking, I mean, I'm sure many of us, this was obviously an accident for this team, but are there precautions that people can take who are interested in exploring caves so they can avoid finding themselves in a similar situation?
Definitely, Tenzin, and thank you for asking. I think that's a great question. One thing I've been trying to reassure folks is that, you know, caving really is an extremely safe activity. In fact, yesterday I took some time out myself to go caving with some friends. And what we try to teach beginners is, first of all, go with people. Don't go by yourself. Having more people does mean safety if something goes wrong. And very importantly, let people know where you're going, not just the cave, but where in that cave that you're going. You know, some caves can have multiple passages. So if something happens and you don't come back in time, the people know, hey, they said they were going up passage X. Let's look in passage X. Additionally, what we recommend everybody is to carry at least three different lights, two headlamps and maybe a flashlight. That way, if you know the batteries die or you drop one, you've got additional light, because obviously, you know, caves are 100% dark. People, you know, see them in movies and there's always a little bit of light, but trust me, when the lights go out, there it is dark. And finally, proper clothing. They were very fortunate here in Thailand that the average temperature of these caves, as I understand it, is in the 70s to 80s Fahrenheit. Here in New York, for example, where I cave mostly, our caves are about 40 to 50 degrees. So we recommend people wear proper clothing and definitely to wear helmets at all times.
Greg Moore with the National Cave Rescue Commission, and we'll have more on this story as it develops. Thanks, Greg.
Thank you, Tanzina.
As media attention is focused on cave rescue efforts in Thailand, heavy rains have also caused massive flooding and landslides across southwest Japan. At least 100 people have died, and 2 million people have been ordered to evacuate the area. William Mallard is Japan bureau chief for Reuters, and he joins me now from Tokyo. Billy, thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Tanzina. It's a pleasure to be with you.
So on the scale of what has happened in Japan historically, where does this type of rainfall fall? I mean, is this one of the worst that we've seen?
It's a bad one, but that said, we seem to be having worst in a century, worst in a half century rainfalls kind of every year. Right now, in terms of the death toll, we're sort of on a worst in 35 years.
And so were these storms expected? Was this just a question of not having the proper protocols in place, or was this something that the locals and the local government were prepared for?
In one sense, they were prepared, and in one sense, you can never be prepared in Japan. You know, Japan is gets inundated around this time of year every year, and certainly in the last few years, and maybe because of climate change, we've had extreme weather conditions every year. But at the same time, there's just the immutable fact that you've got half the population of the United States squeezed into a landmass the size of California with actually the arable land of South Carolina. So people are really squeezed in tight. And that means that whenever there are floods, there are going to be people and buildings and companies in floodplains and squeezed up against hills and mountains where you're going to have floods and landslides. So it's almost inevitable that when these rains come through, you're going to have a whole lot of damage.
Can you give us a sense of what the damage looks like right now? We're seeing lots of aerial footage and aerial photos, presumably from drones and other types of equipment. What are you seeing on the ground?
Actually, now the floodwaters have receded a lot after the main rains have passed. It's been extremely hot. It's, you know, close to 90 degrees Fahrenheit, and a lot of this water has receded really fast. But for a while there, we had people who were really stranded. We had lots of flooding that was up to sort of second floors. There was a very, you know, heartrending scene at a hospital in the Mabi district of Kurashiki City, which is a beautiful tourist city in western Japan that's built on canals. And the patients were all stranded. They were moved up to second and third floors, and a lot of them were helicoptered out early on. But then the waters receded and they were taken away. So now we're in the stage where mud is turning to dust, and we're just seeing very different from the jubilant scenes in Thailand of the soccer kids getting pulled out of the caves. Mostly now what we're seeing is, I'm afraid, you know, old people being found stuck in mud in their homes. And, you know, that's where the sort of casualty figures are coming from.
William Mallard is Japan bureau chief for Reuters. Bill, thanks so much for joining us.
You bet. Thank you.
They have all of our photos. They have all of our driver's license photos.
But now some police departments are using new technology.
He doesn't have to take his eyes away from the scene.
You put that into the systems, that's a vehicle you want to pay attention to.
He can be getting information from his equipment.
It's actually a GPS tracker inside.
Having that early detection can give him time to call for backup.
We find that government jumps feet first into these wide-scale surveillance programs.
All of our passport photos, mugshots, you name it.
They don't think through the protections before doing this.
And so they can take a picture off something like social media or even a camera on the street and use that to find someone.
Law enforcement today rely on more than a gun and a flashlight to do their jobs. Increasingly, cops are using new technologies to police. It's a conversation I started this fall with Andrew Ferguson, author of The Rise of Big Data Policing.
New forms of predictive analytics, new forms of surveillance monitoring, that's changing the way police police. It's changing who they police, it's changing where they go on patrol, it's changing when they police, and in many cases, it's changing how they police.
And we picked up the conversation last month with Dr. Barry Friedman, a professor at NYU School of Law and director of the school's policing project.
You know, there are some people that say all in on technology and some people that are say absolutely no to policing technology. And I think that's the wrong question. The question is, how can we use these technologies responsibly in ways that help us fight crime and violence, but also avoid the downsides that you can have?
So this week, we want to better understand what those technologies and techniques are, including everything from cell phone tracking devices and DNA collection technology to the use of gang databases. Also, we'll be exploring the trade-off between civil liberties and security, which is something many of you are weighing in on.
James, Dover, Ohio. I'm not really worried about policing as long as it does not interfere with my personal life. I have nothing to hide from the government.
Hi, this is Meg from Nashville, and I think the less privacy we have, the less control we have. Linking privacy and safety together is a huge sham, and it's designed to trick the public into sharing their private matters out of fear.
Hi, I'm Michael from Centerville, Utah. How much privacy am I willing to give up in the name of safety? Well, if I'm not doing or saying anything suspicious, why do I care?
Hi, my name is Crash. I'm calling from Milwaukee. The amount of privacy I'm willing to give away in the name of safety? None. I've given plenty up for convenience already, often without realizing or even consenting to it.
Imagine this scenario. Someone breaks into a building, steals a bunch of money, and escapes. But a security camera catches them in the act. With facial recognition technology, police can grab that footage, scan the person's face, and compare it against other photos in other databases and identify that person. Police say they use technologies like these to solve crimes and locate potential suspects, but it's also been criticized for its inaccuracy and potential bias, particularly when it comes to identifying or misidentifying people of color and women. Across the United States, there are a number of companies working in this space, including Massachusetts-based Morpho Trust and South Carolina's DataWorks Plus. And even companies like Amazon are getting into the game of selling facial recognition technology to law enforcement.
Amazon Recognition Video uses the visual, what, temporal, when, and motion from the video to deliver high-quality person tracking and detection of activities like running, playing soccer, or getting into a car.
But at least one company says they refuse to provide their technology to police.
We hope that there is a day where all the good use cases can be done by government with oversight, with regulation. But where we are today is a lack of oversight and a lack of regulation. These things can be used almost any way they'd like to.
That's Brian Brackeen, the CEO of Kairos, an artificial intelligence company specializing in facial recognition. He started out by explaining how the technology works and why he won't sell his product to cops.
Historically, it's worked, and I say historically as in like 2 years ago, it worked with something called machine learning, which means looking at points on your face, measuring the distances between those points, and then creating like a face print or a fingerprint with that. And that approach generally is agnostic to skin tone, race, things of that nature. The new way of doing it, the much faster, much more powerful way, is using artificial intelligence, which is something called deep learning. And what that is like a pixel by pixel, almost like a pore by pore analysis of every single image. And we're comparing everything in that image, including skin tones, shadings, lights, darks. And it's those systems that have a trouble with different races.
Now, let's talk about average, everyday Americans. Do most of us engage with face recognition technology in our daily lives today?
The most common place you'd find facial recognition is the iPhone 10. I think there's millions and millions of those out there now. You may have seen someone using facial recognition to log into their phone. But also large companies like USAA, AARP, and others are also using facial recognition.
And what are they using it for?
Interestingly enough, USAA released some information showing that a lot of seniors were using their facial recognition to log onto their accounts. That way they could just not have to remember their passwords. It would be much more easier for them to use.
So let's talk about the connection between this and law enforcement, which is the issue that we're exploring this week on the show. You know, recently watched a crime show, and it was one of those shows where they show you the different steps that the police go through to find criminals. And they were able to, based off of a social media posting, they were able to take that person's Facebook photo or Snapchat photo and run it through a database of photographs, licenses, for example, and match that to the Facebook photo and then ultimately find a criminal history for this person and get that person off the street. Seems like a pretty good use of the technology, is it not?
I think in the very specific scenario you gave, that's exciting. The challenge is it's never quite that easy, quite that clean. So one of our major issues at Kairos is government's use of facial recognition. They have all of our photos. They have all of our driver's license photos, all of our passport photos, mugshots, you name it. And so they can take a picture off something like social media or even a camera on the street and use that to find someone. And we think that that is not the expectation people have when they go to get a driver's license. So if you are a state, let's say the state of Washington, you can simply take your driver's license database that you already have, put a camera on Fifth Avenue downtown in Seattle, and then figure out who everybody is. And then look for people that have warrants, this or that, or maybe not. God forbid, you're looking at maybe their political backgrounds, you name it. Same is true for people like the FBI or the CIA. They can send anyone, including Facebook, like a national security letter. So they've already got all of our photos. They can then say to Facebook, I want photos of this person. Facebook would have to comply, and then obviously they have all the information they need to make matches anywhere. So these are the things we think that are concerning.
Now, you said you refuse to sell your technology to the federal government or imagine to any government entity. Give us some of the reasons why. And I think race plays a big part in this, right?
Yeah. And so one of the concerns we have is it could be used any way it wants to be used, and it's not fair in the way that it can find people. This is what I mean. Because these systems are trained on different faces, white faces, black faces, Asian faces, you name it, a lot of these algorithms are trained primarily on white male subjects. And because of that, they have a harder time finding women. They have a harder time finding or helping African Americans, or you name it. They're also maybe more likely to false positively identify someone with darker skin tones or a woman versus a man. So therefore, in a government scenario, you'd be more likely to be maybe charged with a crime because of your skin tone or because your ethnicity or gender. Obviously, that's inappropriate.
Now, have you been approached by police or any federal agency to work with this type of software? Are you having conversations like that from the client side?
Yeah, we've had to turn people down from time to time. I would say we're asked about our software by a government agency probably 2 to 3 times a month. And we've also offered at one point, or started some conversations where the government wanted to invest in Kairos for access to our technology. And we didn't take that deal either.
Now, of course, you make this technology and you sell it to private clients, right? So you gave the example of a bank, for example, that might use my face in order to log in to my account. How do I know that even if I'm not working, my data isn't going to the federal government, that a company like yours or someone else's will actually protect that information?
Well, the good news with private companies is, again, they don't have those master databases of your photo. So in the government scenario, you could literally have no idea they're using facial recognition on you as you drive down the street. In the corporate scenario, you would have to at least submit one image the first time saying, this is me, I want to use this service. Now, it is incumbent upon us, and we'd love to see regulation as well about data privacy and data protection, that they don't take that information and then give it to other parties. But at least at the outset, you know what was going on.
And what are your concerns or maybe suggestions to companies that do similar work that you do, that they may say, you know what, this is a great client, federal government will work or state governments will work with me, and this is, you know, all for solving crime and making this a safer country?
I think that oftentimes we lie to ourselves in order for us to feel good about some of these use cases, even when those folks know that their technology probably isn't appropriate for these uses. All of us are all for identifying things like child predators in parks, right? I'm for it. We're all for it. We just need to find a way to make sure that these are the use cases that we're limiting our products to and not beyond that. And for Kairos, we don't believe we can control how a government would use it, so we're not even going to go that direction. But if somebody wanted to focus on that use case, we would totally understand. The challenge for us all societally, and why I'm here today, is as a group, as a society, where do we draw the lines and how can we regulate around those lines?
Ryan Brackeen, CEO of Kairos, an artificial intelligence company specializing in face recognition. Ryan, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. When a 2018 World Cup winner is announced in Moscow on Sunday, one thing's for sure, the team with the trophy for the fourth consecutive Men's World Cup in a row will be from Europe. Four countries are left to fight it out in the semifinals: France, Belgium, Croatia, and England. But European success on the field isn't just a measure of a team's star power. Jules Boykoff is a former professional soccer player and professor of politics and government at Pacific University in Oregon. Jules, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So it doesn't seem like the World Cup, but the Euro Cup or the Euro Mundial, which was one how Spanish language newspaper called it this weekend. Is it a surprise that we're left with these teams again?
Well, in some ways it is, given the recent success of teams, especially from Latin America. But on the other hand, it isn't a surprise because there are some significant advantages that European football countries hold. And one of them is definitely money. This World Cup has demonstrated over and over again that soccer is essentially politics by other means, but it's also economics by other means. These European powers have high-tech training programs, robust youth academies, strong, well-funded domestic soccer leagues that all benefit the European powers. You know, just one example, they have these high-tech automated cages that zip in soccer balls from different angles, and the player is meant to control and pass it, and sort of to teach them the ineffable elements, the creative elements of soccer. A lot of the poorer nations economically just simply don't have that. And so that's definitely one factor at work here. The other one I would say is that there's sort of a colonial boomerang effect that we're seeing at this World Cup that's definitely benefited European countries. So successful European teams in the semifinals have poached players essentially from the talent pools of their former colonial empires. Plus, if you look at World Cup rosters in European soccer powers, there's no question that immigration has benefited them. Immigration, that's a legacy of colonialism. So you look at France, for example, 17 players on their roster were born to first-generation immigrants. Same for Belgium, with glorious players like Romelu Lukaku and Vincent Kompany, whose families immigrated from Congo. And then there's Marouane Fellaini and Nasser Chadli, whose heritage is Moroccan. These are some of the stars of the Belgian team and not bit players.
And I'm wondering, you know, given the political landscape right now, not just in the United States, but particularly in Europe with Brexit and racism and increasingly far right, how are these players being received?
Well, it's very mixed. I mean, this is sort of a battle for the identity of England right now, if you mentioned Brexit. But you have to look at this roster and say that were it not for the diversity of the English team, they would not be in the semifinals. The success of England's team should be read, I think, as a direct rebuke of the insular sentiments that animate Brexit. Maybe another example of Brexiteers getting mugged by reality. So there is a discussion in England right now. There are many players on the England team who have roots outside of England. Even Harry Kane has Irish roots, the big scorer who may well win the Golden Boot for most goals scored in the tournament. Raheem Sterling, another star, was born in Jamaica. Dele Alli's father is Nigerian. So this has really jump-started some important conversations that are happening right now in England, for sure.
Jules, what's the most exciting team that's left for you? Who are you paying attention to going into the end of this?
Yeah, well, I'm excited about Belgium. I think they have just some superstars, including Romelu Lukaku, who is just a really smart player. He can affect a game without even touching the ball by his smart runs and the way he can let a ball through his legs. So I'm excited about Lukaku. I think Croatia is interesting as well. They've had some players speaking out on politics, and before the tournament, their football administration was complete mayhem. So it's a bit of a surprise that they're in the finals. So no matter what, it's going to be exciting. So looking forward to it.
Jules Boykoff, former professional soccer player and a professor at Pacific University in Oregon. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
In Tennessee last week, federal judge Aleta Traeger ruled that a law allowing driver's licenses to be revoked as a result of unpaid court costs was unconstitutional and violated due process and equal protection clauses of the 14th Amendment, which, by the way, turns 150 years old today. Now, here's the thing. States nationwide have similar laws on the books.
Across the country, courts, both state and local, impose fines as a punishment for an offense. And increasingly, since the 1980s, state and local governments have also imposed fees on top of those fines, principally as a way of funding essential government services, everything from courts to police to fire departments.
That's Lisa Foster, who's the co-director of the Fines and Fees Justice Center, an advocacy group working against, that's right, fines and fees in the justice system. More from her in a bit, but right now we're going to bring in Dave Boucher, an investigative reporter with The Tennessean. Dave, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
You know, I've looked at fees and fines in the criminal justice system more broadly across the United States. I'm wondering if you could give us a sense in Tennessee what the fees and fines look like for folks with these low-level offenses. It almost seems like a criminalization of the poor.
Sure, and there are the amount of the fee and the fine can vary drastically. We've been getting slammed with calls since this ruling came out from people to find out if they're eligible, and we've kind of talked to them a little bit about some of the fines they're facing, and some of them are very low. They're $150, they're $200. Some people have fines of more than $10,000 from different offenses in different counties. They can go up and escalate as you don't pay those fines. The reinstatement fee that is in place can also vary wildly. If you don't turn in your license fast enough after your license is revoked, then the fee can go up. They can charge you a $65 fee for every unpaid violation that you have. And so it kind of spans the gamut. There's a huge range of fees that somebody might have to pay in order to get their license back.
Let's take a listen to Lisa Foster again, who we introduced at the beginning of this segment, because she has some thoughts on the consequences of these types of laws around the country.
Today, 41 jurisdictions, including the District of Columbia, suspend your driver's license, many of them automatically, if you can't afford to pay your fines and fees. And when that happens, you lose your job often, you may lose your housing, you might even lose your children. And the problem is particularly severe in communities of color, both because of the demographics of poverty, that is, a majority of poor people in the United States are people of color, but also because of over-policing in minority communities.
Dave, do you agree with that statement?
I would say that the people that we saw affected here in Tennessee were definitely people that are coming from places where they're already struggling financially. Tennessee is a state where public transportation is not readily available. I think in the judge's ruling, she cited an analysis that showed something like 90% or more of the people who are affected by this live in an area where there's not public transportation that's readily available. What the advocates that I talked to here in Tennessee, again, said that people here were frankly all driving anyway, without regardless whether they had their license, if it was revoked for court costs, because they thought it was essential. Because, like your advocate said, they might, you know, lose their house, or without driving, they might lose their job, or they might not be able to pay to feed their children.
Now, what do the folks who defend this law have to say about it?
So first, let's say there aren't that many defenders now after the judge's ruling. Initially, the law was passed in 2012 as a way to bring in court costs. This was something that was pushed by county clerks who said that they were struggling to collect fines, that there wasn't enough of an incentive or there weren't enough ramifications for people who didn't pay their fines. Initially, the bill sponsors expected that the bill would generate $6.5 million every year in revenue for the state. It's unclear yet whether or not that was actually happening. But again, the underlying idea behind the bill is that it would force people to pay these fines that they owe.
Dave Boucher, investigative reporter with the Nashville, Tennessean. And thanks so much for being with us, Dave.
Thanks for having me.
We reached out to the lawsuit's defendants for comment, and the office of Dave Perkey, the state commissioner of safety and homeland security, replied that they will reinstate all driver's licenses and that, quote, we are doing our best to accommodate our customers. We appreciate everyone's patience as we attend to this matter. Every 10 years, the United States surveys millions of people across the country with the census. You're asked about your age, your race, and your relationship status. But since 1950, the census has not asked about your citizenship status, and that may change. Back in March, the Trump administration announced that a new question about citizenship would be added to the 2020 census. In response, 18 states' attorneys general and 9 cities are suing to have the question removed. Last week, a New York judge decided to proceed with hearing that multi-state lawsuit. Attorney General of New Jersey, Grabir Graywall, is among the group of AGs filing that suit, and he joins me now. Welcome back, Attorney General.
Great to be with you.
So your reaction first to the judge's decision in New York.
I'm extremely pleased with the judge's decision to allow the lawsuit to move forward. He's indicated as much. I mean, he's reserved ruling on the motion to dismiss that was brought by the Commerce Department. But all indications are with him allowing discovery to proceed and some of the statements that were made on the record that they'll be moving forward in short order.
So explain to us, I guess, the question. I've covered the census before. It's not easy to get a question on it or off of it, so to speak. How is it that we haven't had a citizenship question, and how easy is it for the president to say we're just going to add one?
Well, that's the rub here, right? It shouldn't be that easy. And they're trying to cram into 4 months what ordinarily would take at least years to hash out, to tweak, to test. And what they're trying to do is rush forward a question which they have claimed is necessary for Voting Rights Act enforcement purposes, which is, as we've seen in documentation and other evidence that's come to light, is entirely pretextual. So it's never been that easy to get a question on, and they're trying to just ram one through in short order here.
I mean, I remember covering the census when they were trying actually in anticipation of this 2020 census, when they were trying to figure out how many questions they should ask about race and identity. And these conversations have been going on for years. So is it feasible that we could see a 2020 citizenship question? And if not, what are you and other AGs trying to do to stop that?
I sure hope not, because as you mentioned, these questions take time to test, and there's a lot of testing done and focus groups and things of that nature, and it has to be statistically accurate, and there's got to be quality assurances. And that's not been done here. And since 1950, as you alluded to, for 7 decades nearly, there hasn't been this question there. And every time there's been an attempt to bring this question forward, the Census Bureau's own studies and data show that it's not necessary, that it would drive down participation, it would not result in an actual enumeration. So what we're doing here is, with this threat to add it, this attempt to add it now, we've gone to court, as you mentioned, with other like-minded attorneys general who find this question to be against the Constitution and cities, to try to prevent it from being added. And the reason we're doing that is because it's a violation of the Constitution.
And explain to us how. What is it about this question that makes it a violation of the Constitution?
Sure. The Constitution requires an actual enumeration of all persons. It's not citizens. It's all persons. And that's what the Constitution requires. By putting the citizenship question on the census, what will happen, and this is their data, their studies, everything that they've put forward over the last number of years, the Census Bureau has shown that if you add this question, it will drive down participation. It will prevent immigrants in particular from coming forward to report or to respond to a census as they're required to do. And for states like mine, we're number 3 in this country for foreign-born residents, it will have a particularly significant effect. When you drive down participation on the census, that's going to affect representation, because representation is based on the entire population, census responses, immigrants and non-immigrants alike, citizens and non-citizens alike. Funding is tied to the decennial census. And as a law enforcement officer, from my perspective, this does nothing but drive immigrant communities further into the shadows when I work tirelessly with cops around the state to bring people forward, to report crimes, to feel comfortable coming to courthouses, to feel comfortable testifying in cases. And when you have this question out there in a climate, and we can't forget about the climate that we're in, where there's an unprecedented anti-immigrant fervor in this country, a lot of it coming from the administration itself, through rhetoric and actions, rhetoric where we are using such inhumane terms to describe our immigrant communities, referring to infestations and animals, referring, warning people to look over their shoulders. And then when we look at the actions of this administration, the Commerce Department, the Trump administration across the board, this is the administration that brought you the DACA repeal, that brought you travel bans 1, 2, and 3, that brought you zero tolerance, that has reduced temporary protected status for so many vulnerable communities across our country, has reduced the number of refugees that we allow in this country, and is threatening law enforcement officers like me, threatening to withhold funding if we treat people humanely and equally. And so, you know, we are fighting tooth and nail to prevent this question from being added to this census, because it's going to undermine everything we do.
And you mentioned funding, and I wonder if our listeners really understand that the census is such an important tool when it comes to funding for certain communities. Is that right?
100%. So much of federal funding is driven by the census results, by populations. Everything from SNAP funding, which is the nutritional assistance program, to highway funding, to educational funding, to housing funds, to you name it. It's all tied to the decennial census. So if there's an undercount, regardless of where you stand on immigration, where you stand on the president's policies, if there is an undercount, which will happen if this question is included, funding will be affected for all of New Jersey and for all the states in particular where there's a high immigrant population.
Now, tell me a little bit about this coalition of attorneys general who have come together to try to essentially sue the federal government to not add this question. Are they from similar cities? Are they from similar states, sorry, that represent very diverse communities?
I think we run the gamut. From California to New Jersey and all in between, from Maryland, we're like-minded states' attorneys general. We're like-minded because we're pro-Constitution. We want this administration to adhere to the Constitution in all of its decision-making. And what we are seeing is that they're abdicating their responsibilities. And if Congress will not act as a check on this president, that we as attorneys general have a special role to play to make sure that the president adheres to constitutional rule of law, to norms, and does what is right by the Constitution. So I am not anti-administration. I am pro-Constitution. And that is, I think, the same belief held by my colleagues.
I wonder if that's something that where do we go from here?
Well, I would hope that the administration corrects its policies. I hope that when the Commerce Secretary has been exposed as being disingenuous and pretextual about this, I mean, he said that this was a decision that he was driven by the Department of Justice to enforce the Voting Rights Act. Emails have come forward saying that's not true. I hope there's some accountability. If you contradict your sworn testimony, I hope he's held accountable for it.
New York State Attorney General Grabeer Graywall, thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
All persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws.
That's from Section 1 of the 14th Amendment to the United States Constitution, ratified July 9, 1868, 150 years ago today. The 14th Amendment made all people born on U.S. soil citizens, including former slaves. With the signing of the 14th Amendment, all at once the country had 4.5 million new American citizens. But it was a long time in the making.
Rather than a story of Congress, lawmakers, and courts, the story of the 14th Amendment is a story of African-American activism.
Martha S. Jones is the Society of Black Alumni Presidential Professor at Johns Hopkins University and author of the new book, Birthright Citizens, A History of Race and Rights in Antebellum America.
150 years ago, slavery had been abolished. Over 4 million people are now free. But there's an open question about what their relationship is to the nation, to the Constitution, and to the body politic, and the 14th Amendment tries to answer that question.
Why weren't those things addressed? Why didn't slavery, when slavery was abolished, automatically give black slaves the right to citizenship?
Well, there's no question that one of the legacies of slavery is racism. And there is an open question in the United States about the degree to which former slaves have the quote-unquote capacity, quote-unquote the intelligence, the ability to actually be part of the everyday deliberations of the state and of government. So the 14th Amendment comes to us as a way of answering that question.
And doesn't this, I mean, I'm sure many things in American history are obviously confusing or confounding, but I just keep thinking about the phrase, all men are created equal, and yet it took a 14th Amendment to really establish that they were also citizens.
Yes, and part of my point of view is that this is part of a longer story of African-American claims making on the nation that long precedes the period of the 14th Amendment, even from the moment of the Constitution's adoption in 1787, African Americans are already pressing on this notion of equality, already claiming for this status as citizens. So part of what you're seeing in 1868 is not simply a brief moment, but the culmination of many, many decades of Black activism.
Why is this a day or this amendment? Why have we not understood it better? And why do you think we don't celebrate this?
I think that there are parts of the 14th Amendment that we have for a long time taken for granted. For example, birthright citizenship is a principle that many, many Americans benefit from, derive their citizenship from, but it's a sort of silent conferral of citizenship rather than an active conferral of citizenship. And so I think it gets overlooked. I think more commonly familiar to Americans is the Equal Protection Clause, which continues to be the subject of much debate. But my view today, sitting in 2018, is that it turns out we need to think hard about birthright citizenship as well, because in our own moment, there are those who are calling for the repeal of the 14th Amendment, particularly its birthright citizenship provision. And so it's a moment today, the anniversary of the amendment is a moment to recall the circumstances out of which it emerged.
Let's fast forward to today. It's the 150th anniversary. Does this amendment still hold up?
Yeah, I would say there are two points of view. One is the view that suggests that birthright citizenship is too broad a way to determine citizenship, that we've opened the door too wide, if you will, is the metaphor.
Have we?
And, well, I would say no, frankly, because I think that part of what going back and looking at the history of the African-American experience in the 19th century tells us is that the amendment was really looking to provide a foundation by which former slaves could fully actualize their economic lives, their political lives, but also their familial lives. One of the things we know about the history of slavery is that it had been profoundly disruptive, in fact, violent when it came to the family lives of African Americans. So when I think about that story and then I fast forward to our own moment, what I am aware of is that today, if the 14th Amendment is inadequate, and the birthright citizenship is inadequate, it's inadequate because it is not honoring the fundamental values around family, particularly the families of immigrants, mixed families of immigrants in this country. And so I do think the amendment needs rethinking, not to put in place a more narrow approach to citizenship, but to put in place an approach to citizenship that continues to honor the integrity of families going forward in this country.
A couple of years ago, there were lots of concerns about the quote-unquote anchor babies coming into the United States. Was that one of the initial, I guess, concerns that led people to, perhaps conservatives, to want to retool the 14th Amendment?
I think that's right. And we've seen that sort of dramatically illustrated for us in the circumstances of mixed status families now, as we watch parents being separated from children by way of deportation proceedings. And that is, in a sense, the 14th Amendment at work, right? Protecting the citizenship rights of those children born in the United States to remain in the United States, to have a claim to residence here. And at the same time, the amendment somewhat violently distinguishing between those children and their parents and exiling their parents, deporting their parents from the country.
How does the 14th Amendment also play out with the population known as Dreamers, those who were born here or who were brought here very young and whose parents are not citizens, but they themselves really had no choice? Does it impact those folks also?
It doesn't. And I think we could say that's one of the shortcomings. The origins of the 14th Amendment were in the acknowledgement that African Americans, former slaves, first and foremost, had not come to this country voluntarily. Once they had been essential elements in the prosperity of the nation, workers, and then as free people building communities, building cities, really a fundamental part of the fabric of the nation. So if the 14th Amendment was meant to affirm, right, that those things are part of what then entitles one to citizenship in constitutional terms, I think that the case of the Dreamers is a powerful analogy, one that at least should lead us to be asking, how is it that we are going to expand the terms of citizenship such that people who have come here not voluntarily have been productive, prosperous, vital dimensions of our society? How do we fully incorporate them? And the 14th Amendment doesn't quite do that.
Martha S. Jones is a professor of history at Johns Hopkins University and author of the new book, Birthright Citizens, A History of Race and Rights in Antebellum America. Martha, thanks so much for joining us again.
Thanks for having me.
And that's our show for today, everyone. You can always call us with anything, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks again for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.